Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, September 26, 2024. South Sudan's foreign minister says his country is serious about peace.
Thus far, we have made tangible progress in our quest for durable peace and political stability in the country. But we have been constrained by resource challenges to fully meet key benchmarks of the agreement.
And VOA reporter witnesses destruction in Sudan's Omdurman.
In the past, it wasn't easy to be here because of the overcrowding. All the shops were open. All the shops were filled with goods. Honestly, the war has changed us Sudanese.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's Foreign Minister Ramadan Abdallah Gooch addressed the 79th session of the United Nations General Assembly in New York Wednesday and appealed to the delegates to support his country's effort to maintain peace and usher democracy in South Sudan. He called on the UN member countries to support South Sudan as the country prepares for elections in 2026.
Implementation of the River Alliance Peace Agreement on the resolution of the conflict in the Republic of South Sudan is primary vehicle for ensuring peace and stability in our country. Thus far, we have made tangible progress in our quest for durable peace and political stability in the country, but we have been constrained by resource challenges to fully meet key benchmarks of the agreement. Nonetheless, all the signatories to the peace accord remain steadfast in consolidating the gains made so far in the form of relative stability and joining hands to complete the rest of the outstanding elements.
Gooch confirmed that South Sudan is experiencing challenges because of many factors, including instability across the region.
Over the last year, the conflict in Sudan is the country neighboring to South Sudan, have created one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. As stated by the United Nations and other United Nations agencies, as an immediate neighbor, we have been impacted by this conflict with about over 800,000 refugees and returnees crossing our borders on a daily basis, coming to South Sudan, fleeing from the war and settling in South Sudan. While we profoundly appreciate the efforts of the United Nations and humanitarian agencies working to alleviate the suffering of the victims of this conflict, we strongly encourage support for the IGAD Peace Initiative to bring about peace to Sudan. Furthermore, we also believe that the international community support for the victims of the war remain inadequate and unresponsive to the impact on the host communities that are also grappling with serious humanitarian challenges. Therefore, we are calling on the international community to expand their support and closely engage with the government of the Republic of South Sudan to mitigate and navigate impact of war on all victims.
He says the Sudanese conflict has affected his country's economy, adding that South Sudan needs support to address the effects of the conflict in Sudan.
Given the fact that our economy is entirely reliant on revenues that we collect from the sale of oil that passes through Port Sudan, we urge the international community to double its efforts toward resolving the conflict in Sudan. We further call for more solidarity with South Sudan as it struggles to overcome and withstand the dire economic impact created by the conflict in neighboring Sudan.
The South Sudanese diplomat says his country stands ready to conduct elections in 2026. Gooch says the Kiir administration is working to ensure South Sudanese get a chance to elect their own leaders.
The government is actively mobilizing resources to conduct the national population and housing census, thus ensuring evidence-based planning and delivering of essential services to the people. As South Sudan capacitates its statistical system and bolsters its analytical capabilities, the government is using the multidimensional poverty index measuring to guide related policies, designing multi-faceted intervention to improve the life of the disadvantaged group and track progress.
He touted his country's efforts to bridge the gender inequality gaps to meet regional and international expectations of the South Sudan government.
South Sudan is making great strides on improvement in gender equality. The government of South Sudan believes that the active engagement of women in governance and decision-making is crucial and critical to ensuring that implementation of commitment contained in the peace agreement that was signed in 2018 and the Mobutu Protocol, the Action National Plan on the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325 and the SDGs 2030 Agenda and African Union Agenda of 2036. UNCSR 1325 is practically powerful advocacy tool for equal representation in national governance.
However, Gorge blames the United Nations for punitive measures imposed on his country. He says the sanction has prevented South Sudan from addressing challenges posed by non-state actors.
The Security Council continue to maintain sanctions, individually target sanctions and the armed embargo despite our call and the call from the African Union and IGAD for this sanction to be lifted. These punitive measures have created a negative impact, restraining South Sudan's full potential by preventing the government from maintaining effective deterrence against negative non-state actors that foment violence and insecurity in our country.
The foreign minister says it is time for the United Nations to do things differently to ensure peace and security prevails across the world.
As a country, we have experienced relative peace and stability for the last 6 years, and continual imposition of these punitive measures is not reflective of the progress we have made so far. Mr. President, for any meaningful peace and security to prevail in the world, we urgently call for reform of the Security Council to be fit for purpose in today's global dynamic and realities.
That's Ramadan Gorge Abdallah, South Sudan's foreign minister, addressing the United Nations General Assembly in New York. He spoke to the delegates on Wednesday. The war in Ukraine, Sudan's humanitarian crisis, and an escalation between Israel and Hezbollah dominated the second day of the UN General Assembly meetings. VOA's correspondent Margaret Bashar has more from New York.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told the UN General Assembly on Wednesday that Russia has failed to subjugate Ukraine on the battlefield and is looking for new ways to break his country, including battering its energy infrastructure ahead of winter. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
This is how Putin is preparing for winter, hoping to torment millions of Ukrainians, ordinary families, women, children, ordinary towns, ordinary villages. Putin wants to leave them in the dark and cold this winter, forcing Ukraine to suffer and surrender.
Separately, diplomats on the sidelines of the UN meetings are calling for calm after a wave of Israeli attacks and airstrikes on southern Lebanon and Hezbollah rockets launched at Israel. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke during a meeting of G20 foreign ministers.
In the Middle East, we're intensely engaged with a number of partners to de-escalate tensions in Lebanon and to work to get a ceasefire agreement that would have so many benefits for all concerned.
The UN said nearly 100,000 Lebanese had been displaced this week as they fled intense Israeli airstrikes, mostly in Hezbollah-controlled South Lebanon. Health officials said at least 51 Lebanese were killed and hundreds wounded on Wednesday. Israel said it shot down a Hezbollah missile aimed at Tel Aviv. At France's request, the UN Security Council met in an emergency session late Wednesday. French President Emmanuel Macron.
We cannot have a war in Lebanon. There cannot be a war in Lebanon. This is why we urge Israel to cease this escalation in Lebanon and for Hezbollah to cease the missile launch to Israel. We urge all of those who provide them with the means to do so to stop doing so.
Meanwhile, in Sudan, a brutal war between rival generals has pushed 26 million people into hunger and famine and displaced at least 10 million people. Nisreen El Saim is a Sudanese peace activist.
We are all aware of the statistics. But let's remember, these numbers represent individuals, people filled with hopes, dreams, and aspiration. Aspiration for a flourishing, united, democratic Sudan. These numbers are me, my family, and friends.
At a meeting about the situation, the UN said it is trying to meet a massive funding gap for aid, disbursing $25 million from its emergency fund. The European Union announced nearly $77 million, and the U.S. said it is giving an additional $424 million. Linda Thomas-Greenfield is the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
We must compel, in fact, insist and demand that the warring parties accept humanitarian pauses in El Fasher, Khartoum, and other highly vulnerable areas to allow aid to flow and civilians to flee.
On Thursday, the General Assembly will hear from General Abdel Fattah el-Burhan, one of the protagonists in the Sudanese war. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Still in New York, as world leaders gather for the annual United Nations General Assembly this week, the charity Oxfam says they are being undermined by what it calls a global oligarchy of super-rich who exert control over the global economy and whom it blames for exacerbating problems like extreme inequality and climate change. The Oxfam report backs an effort by Brazil, which holds the G20 presidency, to impose a minimum 2% tax on billionaires, a move opposed by Washington, as Henry Ridgewell reports.
The United Nations General Assembly aims to provide an equal platform for leaders to discuss the most pressing world issues like poverty and climate change. But a new report from the charity Oxfam says the annual meeting is overshadowed by what it terms a global oligarchy controlled by the ultra-rich and mega corporations. Nabil Ahmed is Oxfam America's Director of Economic and Racial Justice.
And they're shaping the rules in their favour. And they're doing so at the expense of ordinary people, and that in turn is fueling inequality within and between countries.
Oxfam says we are living in an age of extreme global inequality, where the world's richest 1% own more wealth than 95% of the rest of humanity. Again, Nabil Ahmed.
We live in a world in which mega corporations, you know, so many of them are paying little to no tax, basically.
Brazil, which currently holds the presidency of the G20, wants to impose a 2% minimum tax on the world's richest billionaires, which it claims would raise up to $250 billion, a move backed by Oxfam and many other NGOs. The plan is backed by other members, including South Africa, Spain and France. But US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen spoke against the move at a G20 meeting in July.
Tax policy is very difficult to coordinate globally, and we don't see a need or really think it's desirable to try to negotiate a global agreement on that. We think that all countries should make sure that their taxation systems are fair and progressive.
Oxfam says tax revenues in the global south, meanwhile, are increasingly spent on servicing debt to private creditors like banks and hedge funds. The charity also accuses large pharmaceutical companies of shaping rules over intellectual property rights to benefit their shareholders. Oxfam says this meant poorer nations struggled to access coronavirus vaccines, even though billions in government funding went to developing them. Again, Nabil Ahmed.
That's the money that, you know, we put into our tax systems to be able to get there. In fact, decades of investment went into getting mRNA in the first place.
Responding to VOA, Pfizer said the company had offered its coronavirus vaccine at cost price to poorer nations, but that many richer countries moved faster to purchase the available doses. Pfizer's chairman also warned that losing intellectual property rights would disincentivize anyone else from taking a big financial risk in developing such vaccines, a view echoed by other large pharmaceutical giants. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
From London, we go to the city of Omdurman, Sudan's second most populous city. The once thriving market has been all but destroyed by almost a year and a half of war. VOA gained rare access to the city and met residents who recall its former glory as fighting continues to rage in the capital Khartoum on the opposite side of the Nile. Henry Wilkins reports.
Omdurman Market, the shopping hub for the Khartoum metropolitan area, as seen in March 2023, full of people and full of life. Fast forward to September 2024, total devastation, caused by almost 18 months of war in Sudan. Faris Mustafa fled the city when the war started. He's returning to the market for the first time.
In the past, it wasn't easy to be here because of the overcrowding. All the shops were open. All the shops were filled with goods. All our mothers and sisters were here. I mean, the Sudanese community gathered here. Honestly, the war has changed us Sudanese. It's a test from God.
Since the war began in April 2023, the Sudanese government has barred entry to many international journalists. But in September, VOA gained rare access to Omdurman, which is now controlled by the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF. Gunfire and shelling can be heard directed towards positions in Khartoum, held by the opposing paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, less than 4 kilometres away. The owner of this cosmetics store declined to give his name out of fear for his safety. He says shopkeepers were getting ready for a major holiday when the war broke out.
All of the shops were affected. The shooting and chaos started around 2 days before the festival of Eid. People were operating normally and had their Eid products ready to sell.
A year and a half later, analysts say Sudan's war is at a stalemate. Peace talks have repeatedly stalled. Rights groups and the US government accused both sides of war crimes. Just across the River Nile from here is RSF-controlled territory, which is inaccessible to most journalists. Those who have escaped say the destruction there is even worse. The UN says the territory is likely suffering from famine, the world's first in 7 years. But it's unable to confirm it due to lack of access. Mustafa says he just wants the war to end and life to return to normal for the people of Sudan.
May God compensate them, and people should not despair. God willing, one day we will return, and we will rebuild our country and rebuild Sudan, God willing.
Many civilians VOA spoke to shared this hope. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Omdurman, Sudan.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, gender-based violence is taking another shape. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. U.S. South Africa Command, or AFRICOM, is working with Southern African countries to combat gender-based violence in their military forces. This week, AFRICOM and regional military officials are holding a series of workshops in Zambia to strengthen regional collaboration in the fight against workplace harassment. From Gaborone, Mkondisi Dube reports.
AFRICOM and its component, the U.S. Air Forces in Europe and Air Forces Africa, or USAF of Africa, have united with the Zambia Defense Force to foster strategies to tackle gender-based violence in the region. Botswana and Zambia are participating in efforts to strengthen regional initiatives against sexual assault. Lieutenant Colonel Linda Jones is the USAF of Africa Chief for African Health Engagements. She calls it imperative to come up with strategies to fight gender-based violence in the armed forces.
It is the responsibility of leaders at all levels to set the tone and create an environment where everyone is valued and empowered to speak up against misconduct. This involves not only enforcing policies, but also modeling respectful behavior and actively supporting those who report incidents.
In 2021, U.S. Defense Department officials reported sexual violence had reached the highest level ever reported, with 8.4% of women assaulted on duty. U.S. Air Force Tech Sergeant Samara Brown says if left unchecked, gender-based violence can affect execution of military tasks.
Gender-based violence undermines the core values of any military organization. It erodes trust, disrupts unit cohesion, and ultimately compromises mission readiness. We must take a firm stand against it, not just a matter of policy, but as a commitment to uphold the principles of honor, integrity, and respect that define our service.
Retired U.S. Air Force official and workplace development consultant Keith Castile facilitated the Lusaka workshop. He says such collaborations with the Zambia Defense Force can ensure gender-based violence is addressed within regional militaries.
No military can tackle this issue alone. By sharing knowledge and collaborating across branches and communities, we can develop more effective strategies to combat gender-based violence. Engaging in open dialogue, facilitating workshops, and creating joint initiatives will enable us to learn from one another and strengthen our collective efforts.
Attending the workshop in Lusaka, Zambia Defense Force Major Stephen Muleya said the military workplace must be free of gender-based harassment.
When individuals know that they can perform their duties without the threat of harassment or violence, they are more likely to focus fully on their missions. We must actively cultivate an atmosphere where everyone can thrive, free from fear and intimidation.
Zambian officials say they are planning to open a regional office for innovative gender-based violence solutions. Zambian Air Force legal advisor Major Glory Musonda says collaboration with U.S. partners should result in solutions to gender-based violence within the force.
We all have a responsibility to build military environments where respect and dignity are upheld. It's not enough to simply acknowledge the issue. We must actively work towards solutions that ensure the safety and well-being of every service member.
Meanwhile, officials representing the U.S. Army War College are in Lusaka for discussions on women, peace and security, which aligns with efforts to address gender-based violence in the region. Mkondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
From Botswana, we move to Zimbabwe, where authorities are hoping tourism will help revive the ailing economy, as one government official cites new figures that show more tourists are visiting Victoria Falls, known as one of the seven natural wonders of the world. But critics say the country's poor infrastructure is preventing the site from realizing its full potential. Columbus Mavunga reports from Victoria Falls in Zimbabwe.
Even though water levels at Victoria Falls on the border of Zimbabwe and Zambia are lower than usual, tourists like Sarah are still visiting in large numbers.
I am impressed, to be honest. I've been enjoying too much the country and the culture, and also obviously this site, Victoria Falls, is wonderful.
She wants to return one day like Simon, who is from Zimbabwe but now lives in the UK.
I returned to come see Victoria Falls as an experience because when I was younger, I never really got to see it. So last year I came, and this year I brought my friend from the UK to come actually have a view of the great Zambezi and the Victoria Falls here, which is very nice, very beautiful.
But the country's international reputation suffers from what the U.S. State Department describes as credible reports of human rights abuses, including unlawful or arbitrary killings, harsh and life-threatening prison conditions, and restrictions on free expression and media. Economist Gift Mgano says these government practices negatively impact tourism.
That is not good for brand equity. As long as we are doing that, we don't get as much arrival as possible because we earn a bad name as a country. On hardware issues, we need to work on our infrastructure, our roads, our water supplies, our electricity.
Even so, government statistics show the tourism sector had receipts of $493 million in the first half of this year, compared to $398 million same period in 2023. And tourist industry leaders hope for continued growth. Clement Mkwasi is president of the Employers Association for Tours and Safari Operators of Zimbabwe.
The government has embarked on an emergency road rehabilitation program, and some other major roads have started getting attention. Our road shall also get attention in due course. We are not too much worried about that because our airports have been rehabilitated, because also the fact that most of our tourists come from outside the country means that the state of the roads does not completely damage the image of tourism or the numbers that are going to come through into the country.
Mukwasi added that the number of tourists visiting Zimbabwe has been rising since the end of COVID pandemic, and that arrivals were up by 27% in the first half of this year over the same period last year, according to Zimbabwe's Minister of Tourism. He hopes that in future, the sector will rival agriculture, manufacturing and mining as a driver of the economy. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Victoria Falls, Zimbabwe.
And that report by Mavunga brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday, September 26, 2024. We now leave you with Ras Corby and the song and the Nabeled Jadid, which literally means we have a new country. Listening to Ras Corby and the song and the Nabeled Jadid. Ras Corby's band is called Podu. Podu in Bongo language means fire, and Bongo are found in Western Bahar El Ghazal State. For more on our programs, visit www.voaafrica.com. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Bill Bass, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to be with us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.